my name is Sigflup, and welcome to another episode of Miscellaneous Radio Theater 4096. In this episode, we're going to be taking a tour of the Supercomputer Center. The Supercomputer Center here in Minneapolis at the U of M. Minneapolis being pretty much home of supercomputers. Cray coming from here. So here we are, Walter Library, 117 Pleasant. Supercomputing Institute, it says. Here with a couple of friends, Crypto, Total Blackout. Crypto of DC 612, Total Blackout, representing Minneapolis BinRev. And hopefully there will be more people. I've posted about this here and there. We'll see. And we're at the doors. And we're inside.
University of Minnesota's Supercomputing Institute. So we exist on campus to support all the research needs of anybody that's, well, let me back up. So we provide this service to any faculty member at an institute of higher education in the state of Minnesota. Okay. Or their collaborators. So grad students, postdocs, and other faculty member anywhere in the world. We're just shy of 10,000 accounts total in the LDAP right now. The majority of those accounts, I'd say 85%, are right here in the Twin Cities campus. Mm-hmm. But we do have accounts from all over the world, from all over the country. So we are free. So these researchers that want to have access to big data storage, databases, web servers, big compute clusters, as long as they're a faculty member at a higher ed institution, we're free. They just ask. It gets reviewed by other faculty members. There's a committee of peer review, science kind of thing. It's mostly rubber stamp process. You know, oh, you want to do big science? Okay, great. That's perfect for MSI. We like to say we focus on the high end. That's very nebulous, right? High performance computing, what does that mean? You know, this device right here has got the same computational capacity as a Cray supercomputer in the 1970s. Is this high performance computing anymore? No, because there's something else. But generally it's that nebulous, vague cloud at the top end of the spectrum, right? So, that's where we try and focus. So the meat of what's in here are the big supercomputers. But we also do a lot of this stuff. We house all the research data. Okay, so you'll see a machine in here. It's 1,000 nodes, 8,000 cores, all one big machine. We've got some astronomy folks who've used that. The entirety of the machine. One simulation generates 20 terabytes of data. Well, now they want to do something with that. That's just the results of the run. You know, they have no idea what it looks like. They have no idea what it is. They want to make pictures. They want to make movies. They want to otherwise analyze the data. So you got to get everything out. You got to store the data someplace. So we provide all that infrastructure as well. You know, our networking, core networking in this room is all 10 gig. We're directly tapped into the U's 10 gig core. We can also bypass the university's entire network and go straight into the regional optical network called BoreasNet at 10 gig speeds. BoreasNet connects us down in Chicago to the National Lambda Rail, which you could think of as Internet 3, although the fourth generation of that's not being built. We can also then tap into international high-speed networks like Starlight, or we can go to the West Coast, we can hit Seattle and bounce off to the Pacific Rim, all at native 10 gig speeds. So we can have 10 gig pipes from a machine here to a machine in Korea and push all that data around, which is really important because our people want to do that because they have collaborators all over the world. So that's why we're here. Now, half the staff are mine. It's all the systems administrators, systems programmers, database people, web developers. The systems administrators are actually split into traditional infrastructure folk and then the big supercomputing systems. I actually do have a desktop support group. We have some weirdos who use Windows and a lot of other smart people that use Macs. And the rest of us, the smart ones, really smart ones, all use Linux. But for all the staff, we manage all our desktops. We're a little different than most of our peers at the national level because we've got these laboratories. There's two in this building. There's one on the first floor that's for visualization. There's one up on the fifth floor, which is a kind of a more traditional bunch of computers in a room that you can just sit and use our software. We use it for teaching. It's used for experimental things. We're working with Hardcore Computer down in Rochester. They're liquid immersed systems. You know, run them up at 4.5-5 gigahertz.
Wow.
They do everything though, right? They overclock the memory, they're overclocking the GPUs and everything. So we're getting several of those for evaluation, evaluation. we've also got labs south of Washington Avenue in the Academic Health Center area. We've got a lab over in the St. Paul campus. There's actually two on the south side of Washington. So it's a physical space where a user can go sit down and directly interact with all their data at MSF. Because we manage those machines, they directly mount all of our file systems, they can print to our printers, they can use all our software, which is a very beneficial experience, right? I mean, you could sit in a Linux box, you could remote connect, you can pump X sessions back and forth, you can do all kinds of stuff, but it's always better to just be sitting at the real thing. So we've got that. We've got the other half of the organization is support, and that's a bunch of PhD folks in science-specific areas, primarily in the life sciences. We've got geneticists, bioinformatics kind of folk, proteomics, that kind of stuff. But we've also got traditional folks. We got a couple of math PhDs for focusing on statistical analysis, data mining. We actually don't have any computer science PhDs, believe it or not. Yeah, really. I mean, we got two folks from astrophysics, but they are primarily our generic HPC.
This is all in the support group.
It's all in the support group. Yeah. My staff, I think one of my managers has a master's, so the rest of them are all undergrad. And those guys, some of them come from computer science, some don't. I mean, frankly, some of the best computer folks end up with a poli sci degree, actually, you know. And frankly, I'd rather, you know, I do a lot of interviewing, I look at a lot of resumes, and we'll put out a job ad for a systems administrator. I get the recent graduate student from computer science at the University of Minnesota. And all they've ever done is programmed in Visual Basic, and maybe some access databases. Never touched a command line. They don't even know how to spell VI. You know, they've never seen Emacs. They haven't got a clue. I mean, so yeah, it's tough.
You drive with the computer sci people and be like, hey, I can't use any of your people.
Well, yeah, it's a big debate at the national level, frankly, about the curriculum, right? I mean, what we're doing in here has always trickled down, right? What makes a supercomputer super is just that it's bigger and faster, but it's only bigger and faster for a little while, and then it's a gaming machine, and then it's your desktop, and then it's in a laptop, and then it's in the phone, right? It just takes a matter of time to get from here to there. So,
I'm going to go one more sweep for that last guy.
Sure.
I'll be right back.
Hold the door, because if you push the brake bar, it'll sound the alarm.
Oh.
We'll wait here. We'll wait here for you. So just knock.
One big difference, though, is the multi-core aspect.
Well, and that's, so that's the issue, right? So historically, we've seen the gains from Intel. Thank you very much, right? They just make the clock 1 gigahertz to 2 gigahertz, you've doubled your performance. Simple, right? Well, Moore's Law, you know Moore's Law, right? So the real Moore's Law is actually the number of transistors in an area per fixed dollar, which roughly translates into the performance, right? We're still on Moore's curve, Moore's flat line, of increasing our performance if you transmute it that way. As well as the original statement of transistors per area per dollar. But yeah, we're no longer getting the clock increases, and that's a direct result of leakage current.
Man.
Right. So leakage current means more power, right? The smaller we make these transistors, the more they actually leak, and the more power you've got to have. Not only because you got more transistors, but they're not as efficient, actually, so they're leaking more. So, I'm sure you guys have built machines, you know the thermal envelope of a regular Xeon processor in 120-130 watts. You know, it's a light bulb, you burn your hand, you touch those things. So, they've capped it, right? Intel said, we're not going to go any higher than 130 watts. It's just getting ridiculous. So now they go multi-core. And yes, so here comes the problem. We've seen this for years. You know, 4 or 5 years ago, we started talking about we got to change the academic curriculum at the universities because people need to start going back to pthreads and shmem and multi-threaded programming. We've got to do it, right? But it's hard. Well, yeah, it's hard. You know, of course it's hard. Assembly was hard, but you got to know how to do it. Somebody's got to know how to do it because that's where you're going to get the performance, right? So,
it's hard.
So you're going to have to go to a hybrid model where you're still going to have distributed machines and you're communicating with MPI, but then you're going to have these big fat nodes. That's a local device now that you got to start doing threaded applications.
I forgot who it was. I think it was, what's her name, Fran, the person who wrote COBOL, had mentioned that there are three general rules when it comes to speed. Performance, one being the architecture, the other being the compiler, and the third being the algorithm. Mm-hmm. It seems like we've done what we can with the first two. Now, the algorithm's the hardest part.
Well, the algorithm's tough because, yes, you know, you now, and this is a special area, computational sciences focuses on the algorithm, right? And it's always been on parallelizing the algorithm, whether that's for a distributed computing model or a threaded computing model. Somewhat irrelevant, right? But somebody's got to figure out a way to tackle taking the serial thing and making it a parallel thing. Amdahl's law, Gene Amdahl, right? That fraction that you cannot parallelize kills you. And even if you can parallelize 95% of the code, the best you'll ever get is a 20% speed up. You can't get any faster because of that 5% that has to be serial. So we've got to have threaded applications. We've got these multi-core beasts that are just going to get bigger and worse from one perspective. And again, I get a graduate student applying for a job, and they know how to write a single-threaded Visual Basic app. They can talk to an Access database through an EBC. Great, that's not going to help me. not going to help them either. But
real quick, does anyone have any problems, including pictures being taken?
Oh, that's fine.
Mm. No, yeah.
No.
Okay.
No.
Just making sure.
Of what?
Well,
of us?
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose not.
Yeah, that's not fine. All right, now, I'm missing it. I'm in DEFCON mode, and I'm like, I'm used to, well, I got to make sure that people don't mind their picture being taken. So. Mm.
That's fine. That's fine.
Well, I'll give you the finger when you do. That's essentially what.
Yeah.
That's what you have to do.
No, not record.
So that also explains why, like, Intel is moving towards, like, their optic connections, like the FireRunner.
That's coming for a slightly different reason, but yeah. So since about 2000 and.
Was I in the shot?
No.
Ah. 2003. I can't remember the person. Could have been fall of 2002 or maybe spring of 2003. Intel starts holding what they call an HPC roundtable twice a year, once in the spring, once in the fall. Invite only. It's folks like me at the other national centers. And they give us about a 7-year view of what they're doing with the processors. 7 years gets kind of fuzzy. 5 years they've been pretty darn accurate with so far. In 3 years they're already making them, and it's, you know, they might still tweak a few things, but they tell us what's coming. And then they say, in this section of the die is leftover transistors. We got space. What do you guys want us to do with it? So some of the SSE stuff that you've seen, like at SSE 4.1, the new AES encryption and stuff, it's us. Anything vectorized, going back to the 1970s when Cray was doing it, we're throwing it in there because it's being used in these machines. So we've had some influence on the architecture. The QPI, you know, their answer to the hypertransport, moving to an optical exchange. Latency is more the issue than bandwidth, frankly, right? So 50 megabits a second or gigabits a second, everybody thinks of this. That's really cool. Well, I'll show you networks in here that are 80 gigabits a second, 40 bidirectional.
You'll probably put a bunch
that's fine, you know. Okay. So having that in silicon and having that within a board, that's going to be kind of cool too, but it's more the latency, right?
Because they're sharing memory, effectively.
Yeah. So here's the classic question. What is this?
It's a nanosecond.
Bingo. That's 30 centimeters. That's a nanosecond, right? And so you start talking about bigger dies because you're putting more cores on them, you know, and I'm sure it's no surprise, they've already got roadmaps for their 12 nanometer fabrication techniques. You know, they've just released their 45s and 32s and 22s max, and 12s coming, and they're looking at 8. So you're going to have, and we're up to what now, 3 billion transistors, something like that, on a typical Nehalem 6-core Westmere kind of processor. You know, the dies are going to get bigger. So what we're calling a processor these days with all the cores inside it is physically going to get larger. You're still going to have multiple sockets of them. You still got to have memory, and you're already beyond a nanosecond. And that's big thing. That's a really big thing. They're going to be able to push the clocks a little bit higher incrementally as we go along. Instead of hovering around the 2.2s, the 2.8s and stuff like that, we'll get back into the 3s, the low 3s, even with these high core counts. But now you've got a bus out there somewhere too, and it gets really important have as low a latency transport as possible. So the bandwidth isn't the problem. It's the latency. Let's go on in.
All right.
So you guys have been in data centers before.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
One thing you'll notice here is we run a little hot. We've got an airflow problem. So the building was, the state put about $63 million in 1999, I guess, 2000, somewhere around there, into restoring this building, the library, and renovating the space. MSI used to be across the river. There's actually still a sign. If you're on Washington Avenue, just after you go across 35, the west side of 35, there's a sign on the northwest side there. It says Minnesota Supercomputing Center. So back, we're 25 years old. So back in the mid-80s, when some of the faculty got this started, we were one of the first, well, we were the first university to buy a Cray machine. And they realized, man, it's really hard to operate these things and make them run and everything else. So the university spun off a company called the Minnesota Supercomputing Center, a corporation, MSC. And then the university kept the Minnesota Supercomputing Institute, which leased computer time from MSC. So we would deal with the researchers, we'd handle the allocations of things, and then manage things with MSC. Well, when this building became available, we'd already made the decision to start running our own machines. And so we had some stuff to move over here. It was a bunch of IBM SPs. That was the big machine. Deep Blue, the one that beat Kasparov, was an SP. So we had about 20 frames of that that we're going to bring over here. And that was it. And we had a few other machines that were literally sitting on the floor at times, you know, racks were kind of coming into vogue. And, early to mid-90s is when all this stuff was acquired, and we moved in here in 2000. It's about 3,600 square feet of space, and I thought, well, geez, they're never going to use that much. You know, 375,000 watts of power, they'll never use that. 80 tons of air cooling, we'll keep going for forever.
640K of RAM was enough.
Yeah, that's right. 640. Thank you, Bill. So yeah, we're
640 kilowatts is enough for me.
So to put the latest machine in, I had to add another 500 kilowatts. Now the total power into this room is 1.25 megawatts. I still only have the 80 tons of air cooling. It's in the sub-basement below us, the air handlers and the chillers that they put in. Well, the chilling towers are, of course, outside, but I get chilled water that runs through here. And that's all that these things can handle. We also economize our cooling in the winter. So we'll suck in air from the outside. It runs through filters. It gets pushed into the air handlers, and then handles the same thing. But with fans sucking in and fans in the air handlers and fans blowing up under the plenum and then fans in the returns, there's been times when there's a vacuum seal and you can't get the door open and you leave and the door's sitting here floating because the air pressure's, it's overpressurized in there.
So you want to have the fluid dynamics people help you out with all of that? Put a little wind socks all over the...
Well, we've actually analyzed it to death. We have done that. And there's a bunch of structural issues in here. We can't put nice plenums and duct on the returns on the ceiling because of the ribbing from the floors above us and fire hazards and sprinklers and all these other things. So we live with it a little bit warmer than we normally would like. Of course, Intel is pushing that you can run data centers at 90 degrees, 80 degrees Fahrenheit. They stand behind that. You know, they're saying there's no problems in that. As long as you actually get flow to keep the heat moving off of the vanes, you know, the cooling vanes that are on the top of the processor, that's okay. But that's a lot. You know, and I don't know about all the other components. Right? Intel's saying, yeah, my silicon. But there's a lot more in a system, of course, than the processor. So, but we've gone to water cooling, direct water cooling. Well, semi-direct water cooling. We have water-cooled doors on the backs of these things. So we're still doing a classic suck in the front, cool the unit, and blow out the hot in the back. But my hot aisle is now cold again because I've got chillers right there at the back of the racks cooling that hot air.
Cool.
And in one case, you'll see it's totally self-contained. It's like the APC solution. This is actually from their tall, it's the side racks. you seal off the front and the back. They don't actually suck air in. It just circulates around inside. So.
Is that pretty good for maintenance then? Or?
Yeah, it works out just fine. Next. It really doesn't get in the way. You'll see.
We're entering two giant doors, one of which says high voltage all over the place.
So
there's a picture of Elmo and a sun.
So about halfway down, you can see the dark gray with the silver front. That's actually a supercomputer, but the rest of this is our kind of infrastructure for the most part. Yeah, right. I mentioned we do have the goofy Windows Mac thing going on. And that's most of the core standard Unix infrastructure. File, print, database, bin storage, web, everything else. We name our systems after lakes, not Sesame Street characters. So this is Lake Elmo. These are just some big fat nodes, no real high-speed interconnect. Very good for MATLAB. Believe it or not, people actually consider that a programming language rather than an application. yeah, there's some statistical stuff. A lot of genome sequencing happens here. All right, these are 128 gig of RAM machines, so single thread and a bunch of memory is kind of nice. We do tinker around with the dark side very carefully. So these SGI nodes are actually each unit's two nodes. You see a toka board's in there.
I thought you were gonna say like you crack a password hashes or something like that by tinkering around with the dark
really
side.
No, not really the dark side.
Okay, I see.
I don't like to touch it much, but yeah, there's 80 cores in there, and frankly, it actually kind of works.
Yeah, I've heard Microsoft HPC is like actually something they did, somewhat confidently. Like
they've done a very good job of stealing smart people. so they got a real good set of folk working on this, and they're turning out a pretty decent product.
Still doesn't have the flexibility.
So, but the big stuff.
There we are.
So I'm sure you guys have seen blades, right? Jay? No?
Never seen one in person.
Well, you will now.
Performance, it says here, 6.22 teraflops, theoretical. What
right,
it says.
Simple concept. Take the 1U pizza box with everything in it. Take all the common crap out. Put it in the blade chassis. So now the blade is just compute and memory, basically. Right? Frankly, IBM's doing this has been doing this concept for about 12 years. I mean, you could buy one of the high-end models a long time ago. It was called the IBM S80. And you'd buy this huge half rack of stuff, and it was nothing but processors and memory. And that's it. Nothing else. Some cable ports in the back for what they called RIO, Remote I.O. Then you bought another big chunk, and it was all the PCI buses. That's where you put all your adapters and everything else. So IBM's been splitting proc and memory from the rest of the system for a long time. And this is just a natural evolution of that. Right? So the blade, your node that actually runs the OS, has no Ethernet, has no InfiniBand, has nothing else. It gets all that from the chassis. Right? It's got a special passive connect into the chassis, and that's where all the networking takes place. So we wire up to the back of the chassis, bring everything back to the InfiniBand, and there you go. So these are old, about 4 years, dual socket, dual core AMDs, but the machine runs fine. It's about 1,100 cores total. The history behind all this, we've done it. So the history behind all this is literally rocket science. Okay, so in the very early 90s, a gentleman by the name of Tom Sterling and his friend Donald Becker worked for NASA. They were asked to be on a team that was going to verify a new rocket engine.
They said, sure, we'll do that. And so they submitted their budget request, and the budget included a couple million dollars for the latest, greatest supercomputer of the day so they could do the analysis. And NASA said, hey, great budget plan, but we're not giving you money for the computer. But you still got to do this analysis. They literally went out, they scavenged 16 old 486 machines and created the first commodity cluster supercomputer that they named Beowulf. So I actually helped hire Tom Sterling away from NASA to Louisiana State University about 5 years ago. And I asked him, how'd you come up with that name? And he said he was literally at his mom's house sitting down in the rocking chair trying to think of what he should call this machine and saw her old copy of Beowulf on the bookshelf, and it just stuck. So now Beowulf is a generic class of system, right, besides a proper noun. That concept has simply evolved, right? A bunch of distributed machines all running their own copy of an operating system participating in a single application, communicating over what's hopefully a really good network, right, for passing data, passing messages and stuff. If you looked at the top 500, which is a website, top500.org, tracks the fastest 500 machines in the world, in 2000, I think there were two Linux clusters on that list. Today, I want to say that 95% of them are Linux clusters.
Now,
right?
What's the most supported distributed computing operating system? I've been looking, I looked at some of them, and I see there's support stopped years ago for quite a few of the distributions.
Which Linux you mean?
Yeah.
Right, so the answer is Linux.
Linux.
The other question, or the you know, which specific distribution, I wouldn't say there is one.
Okay,
people
okay.
build it with everything.
Right.
You can do it with Debian, you can do it with Gentoo, you can do it with, I mean, these are all running SUSE. Some people run RHEL, some people just choose CentOS. There's scientific Linux, which is special patches to CentOS. I mean, it runs the gambit. People do Ubuntu clusters. Doesn't matter.
Do you guys use the pop stuff?
Depends. So that guy down there is just NFS, plain and simple. This guy here is running Lustre for its high-speed file system. Calhoun on the other side is running PAN-FS, the Panassus file system. We experimented on this guy for a while with Gluster, not Luster, Gluster, starts with a G. PBFS 2, so CXFS, the clustered XFS file system from Silicon Graphics, GPFS from IBM, the global parallel file system. So any distributed parallel file system is typically what you're going to find on these clusters. But sometimes just plain Jane NFS works just fine. You know, especially if you got nice fat 10 gig bytes. So,
wow.
So I was mentioning the 80 gigabit network. It's right here.
Wow.
It's InfiniBand. It's QDR InfiniBand. So again, each channel is 40 gigabits, but there's a dual channel, 80 gigabits, 1 microsecond latency, node to node, 0 byte payload. But real payload, you'll see 2 to 3 microseconds. If it's really big payload, maybe 4, 5, 6 microseconds. But again, this is the magic glue. This is what makes, this is the secret sauce. Right? This plus the message passing interface, the MPI libraries. So back in the day, on the first machine called Beowulf, they used what's called PVM, Parallel Virtual Machine. And it basically took the 16 nodes and made it look like one, but it wasn't really. They hid the fact that it was a 16, obviously. So from the user's perspective, you could do an LS. You see the processes in all 16 machines. PVM was going out and doing everything it needed to do. I said LS, I meant PS, right? So, but there were no standards. It was a research project out of Carnegie Mellon, and they grabbed it, and they made it work on Beowulf, and other people took it and made it work, but there were no standards. Everybody realized this is crazy. So the good folks at Argonne National Labs came up with a standard. They formed committees of academics. It took them years, but they came up with an MPI standard. And then Argonne also wrote the definitive reference implementation. It's called MPICH. So with MPICH installed on your system, with an application written against an MPI library, right? You can do C code, Fortran code, there's Perl bindings, there's Python bindings, there's PHP bindings, there's Lisp, Ada bindings, there's all kinds of bindings to MPI lives from all these different languages. You can launch an application with a resource manager across all these nodes, fire them up, and they'll start to coordinate, communicate, work in parallel, however you did it, whatever the algorithm is. So, one thing I wanted to bring up on what you said, the second of those three, the compiler, is still a huge issue. A huge issue, right? Because you got all these dumb computer science people out there, and if there was automagic parallelization, we'd all benefit, wouldn't we? So the compiler is huge. And there are, you know, many PhD theses still out there being written around how to make an auto-parallelizing compiler or solving various problems in that area. So, but this is our latest. This machine debuted at like, God, I should know, like mid-50s on the top 500 list. It's now somewhere in the 70s or 80s. So a fairly fast machine. The Calhoun machine over in the corner actually debuted at number 47 in the fall of 2007. It's not on the list today.
Wow.
You know, it just fell off. It's too slow. Won't even make it. So things happen fast. They change quickly.
Do you think Haskell might be a good language to auto-parallelize in the compiler?
You know, I haven't done enough on Haskell. I don't know. Is it Haskell or Pascal?
Haskell.
Haskell. Haskell. Oh, okay. Yeah. I've personally not touched Haskell. I know some people who swear by it, and they're smart people, so maybe it would.
You don't actually write the procedure. The compiler generates the procedure. You just define, you define the result. So for writing auto-parallelizing compiler, I think that would be good language.
It could. Yeah, very well could.
So you haven't heard much of that used on these systems?
No, not on these systems. No, again, it could be some research project somewhere else.
For myself, I've heard, I haven't used Haskell myself either, but I have heard it's in related to parallel processing a lot. So apparently there's a lot of research there. That's interesting.
Yeah. So the cooling, right? So here's the refrigerator for this set of nodes. You see the hole? But it's not, right? It's plexiglass, weather stripping, keep all the air contained.
This is where the battery on the recorder died, unfortunately. So you can't listen to the remainder of the tour, unfortunately. It was a lot of fun. There are a couple of other computers there. And I forgot to mention the one that we got cut off of. I believe the peak performance was 94 teraflops. So what we did after that is we went upstairs where they had this visualization room, which was right awesome. Really cool. They had three projectors projecting onto three surfaces that surround you. And There's sort of flickering back and forth with LCD shutter glasses, and the glasses you wear have a tracker on them. And so it's pretty much virtual reality, right? It's a 3D picture shown on these three screens from your perspective as you move, which was hella fun. Our tour guide was primarily talking about how it was used primarily at the very moment for visualization of hearts and all these medical things and veins and whatnot. What we did get to play with was this 3D paint program, which was really cool. And completely forgetting the name of the library, I don't know if this is the library they developed for it, the 3D library, or the name of the program that we used. It was right awesome. You held this little wand, and you painted in 3D space. And we had a great deal of fun. We, I believe, Zach, a member there, representing 2600, the 2600 meetings here, MN2600, asked, what did he ask? I think it was something like Unreal Tournament, yes or no, or something like that. Like, oh, well, we don't run this game, but we run this game. It's kind of difficult, though, because most games aren't meant for three screens, so you have to have a couple of players that sort of follow the other player, and whose perspectives are moved in the proper rotation as the screens are oriented. So I thought it was kind of funny they admit to playing 3D shooters on their big screens. But that's it. Thanks for listening, and hopefully we can do this again. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.